Never talk to Elizabeth again. His life and hers could probably be measured with an hourglass. Vic lifted her head.
Did you hear something?
Is that shouting? He straightened up. Is there someone outside?
Ah, damn it, said Vic.
Their heels rang against the catwalk. They joined Alex and the others as they headed for the front of the building. Doug moved to peer between the slats of the boarded-up window, but Murdoch stopped him with a sharp, I wouldn't do that.
Why not?
Murdoch tipped his head to the racks of glowing instruments and vacuum tubes behind them.
They'll see your shadow moving gives them a target.
Chase took a cautious step back.
Are they? Would they really notice that?
Barnabas would.
Which one's Barnabas?
Kind of looks like a skinny albino version of the Red Skull.
We should be safe as long as we don't get too close to the window frame, said Alex.
Too dark to see anyone out there anyway, said Vic.
I think I see them,
Seth said. He raised his head, squinting through the boards from a few feet back.
Shapes, anyway.
Murdoch nodded and blinked his oversized eyes.
I can see them, too.
Not sure we can trust what you say, muttered Doug.
Fine, get up close to the window again.
Chase inched a little closer and let his eyes adjust to the darkness outside. He closed his eyes and let them adjust a little more. He could see the barest of shapes down in the starlit clearing. Shadows among the shadows. One of the dark shapes stepped forward. A yellow flare sputtered to life, giving Chase a quick glimpse of a big, wide-mouthed woman before she tossed the flare across the clearing. It landed and spread flickering shadows around the front of the building. 5 or 6 feet into the clearing stood a tall, slim woman with dark hair pulled back against her head. Her shirt hung open, and in the dim light, Chase thought it gave her a sultry, femme fatale appearance. Then he realized who the woman was.
That's Anne? He asked Vic. The one in charge?
I don't know, she replied, pushing herself up onto her toes, because I can't see her.
It's her,
Murdoch said in Chase's ear. He jumped as he realized how close the man had gotten to him. Anne looked up and smiled. Not at them. Even from here, Chase could see she was looking at the wrong window. Or maybe she just had her head angled the other way and her eyes were pointed right at them.
I can see movement inside, she called out. So I know somebody else is in there.
Doug,
Chase snapped.
Sorry, I just wanted to see.
You can come outside and surrender peacefully,
Anne continued.
You won't be hurt. We don't want to hurt anybody. We just want to do what's right. I'm sure you want that, too. I don't trust her, said Vic.
Murdoch let out a dry laugh.
You dated her, too?
No, I just... Wait, she's your girlfriend?
Ex. It was a long time ago. Things were different.
I understand. You think you're on the right side,
Anne said to the building.
That you're doing the right thing. The old man probably told you lots of stories about saving the world from horrible monsters, so I'm sorry I have to do this.
Her arm slid back, her hand gestured.
The skull-faced man stepped out from the trees, dragging someone behind him. He twisted his shoulders and flung the figure into the clearing. The man stumbled, dropped to his knees, and pushed himself back up.
I'm going to count to 10, said Anne. And then I'm going to ask Barnabas to shoot this man in the back of the head. To be very clear, we're going to kill him if you don't open the door and come out.
Vic squinted between the slats.
Who is that? Is it just one of their own people?
Murdoch shook his head.
I don't know him. Never seen him before.
The man looked up at the building. Chase had a sudden memory of sea spray and sunlight.
Oh, crap.
He heard Seth take in a quick, sharp breath.
Do you know him?
Asked Alex.
10,
yelled Anne. Chase glanced over at Seth for confirmation.
It's Katanga, said Seth. The first mate from Makara.
37.
Nine,
Anne's voice echoed. Murdoch's leg throbbed as he turned from the window to face the others.
Let me go out to talk to her.
Seth laughed.
She knows me. She'll listen to me. Maybe long enough for your guy to get away. How are we supposed to get him away?
Eight.
I don't know. You can make a distraction or something.
How will he know what to do? Asked Chase. We'll catch him off guard just as much as them.
I don't know, Murdoch said again. I just know she wants to talk more than she wants to shoot anyone.
How do you know that?
Because I've known her most of my life, and I know when she wants something.
Chase raised an eyebrow.
Oh, grow up.
Seven.
Doug cleared his throat. This could all just be a bluff so he can get out and give her information about us.
It's not a bluff, Murdoch said.
Yeah,
agreed Veek.
What's he going to tell her? We're all in here and we're going to die in an hour, too?
Chase looked at Alex.
You've been pretty quiet. What do you think?
I think they can't be trusted, any of them. The family will do anything to carry out their goals. Destroying the machine,
said Veek.
Precisely. Six.
Well, yeah, Murdoch said. But that's all kind of moot now, isn't it?
Chase furrowed his brow.
What's that supposed to mean?
Murdoch lifted his cuffed hands and gestured around them.
The machine's dead. Dying at best. The squales have come through. This is everything the family's ever hoped to achieve.
And?
Asked Veek.
Five.
Murdoch tilted his head at the window, out at Anne.
So why is she trying to bargain with us?
Chase opened his mouth, shut it, looked out the window, looked at Alex.
You think?
Veek looked Murdoch right in the eyes. It seemed odd, and he realized it was the first time she'd looked at him without blatant hostility.
You think she knows something we don't? Maybe this isn't the end?
I think, said Murdoch. It's worth finding out why she's still so determined to get in here.
At the least,
Alex said, staring through the machine to the control area.
He buys us a little more time. Four.
Murdoch looked at Chase. Chase shrugged.
I say we let him talk to her.
Thank you. Veek sighed.
Yeah, sure, why not?
Because he's going to stab us in the back, said Doug.
Seth?
She knows something, Seth said. Or we're all missing something. Let him talk to her.
Three.
Doug rolled his eyes.
Oh, now you trust him?
I don't trust any of you, said Seth. But he's got a point. If she's already won, why is she talking to us?
Their eyes turned. Murdoch followed their gaze to Alex. The man in the old safari clothes said nothing. He raised his hands to his mouth and tapped his fingers together. Chase looked back at Murdoch.
Go for it.
Murdoch took a cautious step toward the edge of the window.
Two.
Anne?
Even from 30 feet away, he saw her flinch and felt a tiny bit of tension unwind from his body. If hearing his voice made her react, it meant he could still reach her. It gave him somewhere to start from.
Murdoch?
So much packed into his name. Surprise, a little relief, some confusion, but nothing negative, no anger or suspicion.
Yeah, he called out. It's me.
What are you? You're inside?
Yeah.
How?
I'll come out and tell you.
Anne paused.
You'll open the door for us?
I'll come out and talk.
He could see her scowl.
What's going on?
The suspicion finally blossomed in her voice. He stepped away from the window.
I'm coming down, he yelled.
Murdoch,
she shouted back. He turned to Chase.
Well?
Chase's eyes flicked to Veek, Alex, then Seth.
Yeah, let's go.
They headed back down the catwalk to the stairs. Not quite a walk, not quite running. Murdoch's wounded leg sent hot pain up his spine as he dropped to each step. They turned a corner on the staircase and he realized Alex had stayed behind, up on the second floor. They hit the ground floor and Chase put his hands on the two sliding bolts holding the cable-framed front door shut.
You sure about this?
Not really, Murdoch admitted.
That's reassuring,
muttered Veek.
Just being honest.
Chase slid the bolts and pulled the door open. He nodded. Murdoch nodded back before twisting and sidestepping through the narrow opening. The bolts thudded shut behind him. The flare sputtered away a few feet from the stoop. Murdoch squinted at it, guessed it had burned maybe halfway through. He moved down the steps, ignoring the twist of fear and nausea in his stomach that threatened to push him down to his knees. Off to his right, a figure sprawled on the ground, clothes bright yellow in the flare's light. He shuffled left, trying to see past the flare. A figure mirrored him, moved even further to the left. He blinked away the blur of bright light and saw Anne standing before him. He took a step forward. She didn't. Hey.
Hey,
she echoed. The suspicion was gone, but her voice had a healthy dose of caution in it. He took another step forward and stopped, trying to ignore the hot pain in his thigh. Off to his right, he could see the hostage, Katanga, on his knees. Barnabas stood a yard or two behind the man, his rifle slung, but his pistol out and hanging casually at his side.
So,
said Anne.
You got captured,
he shrugged.
Sort of.
Her mouth moved into a faint smile, her slightly condescending one that managed to be scornful and sexy at the same time.
You're in handcuffs and you're bleeding, Murdoch. How much more captured do you need to be in your mind?
They didn't capture me. I surrendered.
Why?
He opened his mouth and paused as a dozen thoughts plowed through his brain.
Because I finally realized the truth.
Her brow furrowed.
Which is?
Another dozen thoughts raced forward, collided, fought to be out in front.
I saw one of them, Anne.
She sucked in a little breath, made a small, tight sound, almost a squeak, but he knew from experience she'd go nuts if you called it a squeak. The sound of her almost peaking with excitement.
One of what?
She asked cautiously, hopefully.
One of them, he said. The great ones. I saw it over this island.
She shuddered, the joy, the release.
Yes,
she said.
You don't know how happy this makes me. All this time I was worried about you, but to hear that you understand the—
No, he said, shaking his head. You don't get it.
Her body stiffened.
What?
He glanced at Barnabas, at the shadowy forms lurking back in the woods. He took another cautious step forward.
Anne, he whispered. These things, they're monsters. Real end of the world monsters.
Her shoulders relaxed.
Of course they are. I know it's a little overwhelming at first, but give it time. You'll remember. When we were kids, this is just what Auntie Bradbury and the others used to tell us about.
No.
He raised his hands, and the chain between them chimed. Barnabas stiffened and brought his pistol up a few inches, almost aiming it at Murdoch.
This isn't what she taught us. They don't care about you or me. They don't have some great plan. They're just monsters.
Anne nodded.
I know it can be interpreted that way. It's overwhelming at first when you realize the truth and see it all laid out before you.
Her smile stretched wider across her face.
But soon this horrible place will be destroyed and the great ones will be free to cleanse the world of all its...
They aren't gods, Anne. They aren't going to do anything for us. They're just going to feed on everything.
She shook her head.
No. Once they're free, once they're allowed to carry out their divine mission, they'll reward all of the faithful. Our belief will carry us into the new world, a world where our differences won't matter.
Murdoch bit his lip. The flare sputtered once, twice, and dimmed. Anne went from a brilliant, gold-hued vision to an underlit figure.
What do you mean? He asked. Once they're free.
She blinked.
What do you mean?
Just that. You keep talking about when they're free.
Because that's when we reap our rewards. That's when being one of the faithful, one of the family, finally grants us our...
They're out, he said. They're here. Now.
She shook her head.
Not yet, but soon. So soon.
No. Now. When I told you I saw one of them, it wasn't some metaphor or vision or something. They're already here, Anne. They're here in our world, and guess what? The family hasn't gotten shit.
She sucked in a harsh breath. So did Barnabas. A few more whispered out of the dark.
I don't know what they've told you, Murdoch, but you need to remember the truth. Remember what we were taught as kids, what they...
I do remember being kids, he said. I remember what we thought about all those stories and lessons. Do you?
She glared at him.
We were foolish children.
No, we weren't. We weren't, and you know it. We saw through all this propaganda, this brainwashing the elders forced down our throats.
A low grunt, almost a growl, came from Barnabas. Anne reached up and slowly buttoned her shirt. She took a step closer as she finished, leaned in toward Murdoch.
Why are you saying these things? What did they do to you in there?
They didn't do anything. It all happened out here. It happened when we were growing up together and when I saw that damned thing up in the sky.
Even in the dim light of the flare, he saw her eyes flick up toward the dark clouds.
You told me seeing a seraph made you realize everything they told us was true. Well, seeing this convinced me it was all wrong. It's a monster, and we have to do everything we can to fight it, to fight all of them.
Why?
What do you mean, why? So we can live, so we can have an actual life. That was the plan when we were kids, remember, to get away so we'd never have to deal with any of this ever again.
She pressed her lips together into a hard, flat line. Then her shoulder flexed, her arm came up, and a dark circle filled Murdoch's vision. He saw a bright flash, felt something sharp in the corner of his eye. His thoughts went dark, and...
38.
Jesus Christ!
Chase flinched back. He'd watched the exchange from one of the lower windows flanking the front door, looking through a narrow gap between the protective planks. He'd seen Anne bring up the pistol and... point blank, in the face. The echo of the gunshot faded before Murdoch's body hit the ground. The man just tipped back, crashed into the dirt, and became another shadow on the ground.
That bitch,
Seth said through his teeth. Veek touched Chase's shoulder.
Get away from the windows.
She killed him.
Yeah, they do that. Get back.
Jesus!
All of you, called Alex. Both feet on the catwalks. He bounded down the metal staircase, pausing halfway to pull apart two connectors the size of hardcover books. As they separated, a tiny arc stretched between the brass pins. Chase watched as Alex grabbed another connector, this one near the base of the stairs.
What's going on?
They still have Katanga at gunpoint.
Seth craned his neck as he peered through his own gap on the other side of the window.
The rest of them are moving closer, coming out of the trees.
Excellent. Away from the windows, Alex said. Stand straight, no leaning or touching anything. He slid aside a chest-high metal panel near the catwalk, revealing something that looked to Chase like an old telephone switchboard. Alex unplugged, moved, and replugged three cables in quick succession. Veek squinted at the board.
Didn't know that was there,
she murmured.
What are you doing?
Quickly, everyone on the catwalk, arms at your sides. Alex stepped past Chase and Veek, reached up and wiggled his fingers over a vacuum tube.
I'm good,
yelled Doug from the staircase landing. Alex met Chase's eyes and plucked the tube free of its socket. The lights flickered and went out. The machine trembled and let out an electric yowl. A wave of dizziness hit Chase right between the eyes, rushed through his head, and plunged down his throat. The worst level of drunkenness achieved in just half a second. The machine shook and spun around him, his stomach convulsed, weighing the pros and cons of emptying itself across the catwalk. Something hit his knees, then his hands, and he realized he'd dropped to all fours. The howling faded, and quiet settled across the machine. He heard Doug groan, followed by a wet, retching noise.
"What was that?"
slurred Seth.
"What happened?"
Chase swung his head to the side, and the machine swayed with the movement. He shifted his hands to keep balance, and the metal grating of the catwalk scraped at his hands. Veek kneeled a few feet away, upright with one hand around her gut. She took a few slow, deep breaths. A yard or so past her, Chase's vision still swam around too much to be sure, Alex crouched against the wall, one hand white-knuckled around a support.
"The discomfort is unavoidable," Alex explained, "especially in a cruder transition like this. The sudden shift in pressure causes it. The auditory canal, digestive tract, and respiratory system are most affected, although in extreme cases the transition can cause brief unconsciousness."
Somewhere a mechanism still spun, letting out a low wail as it did. The shriek rose in volume as it powered back up, but became more erratic. It halted, changed pitch, and a competing screech kicked in. Then one of the people outside took in a deep, ragged breath and screamed again.
"What did you do?"
Chase tried to sound insistent, but it sounded more like a desperate croak. Alex pulled himself upright.
"The walls of reality are thin on this island. It's not uncommon to catch hazy glimpses through them. In some areas, they are like tissue, and the slightest pressure can tear them. Small, temporary rips are not uncommon."
Veek reached up to press her hand against the side of her head.
"That doesn't sound good."
"In a way, the machine is like a fist, squeezing so tight to hold large things, it cannot help but create gaps for small ones. Normally it does cause some issues, but in this case I was able to use it to our advantage."
"How?"
"As it happens, there was enough power left in that fist to smash a hole through the walls, one roughly the size of this island." Chase took another breath and willed his stomach to be calm.
"You did what?"
"I created a small overlap between two universes. Two islands are existing in the same place at the same time. We were very careful with placement, so the machines overlap perfectly, but out there..."
He turned his head to the window. Chase followed his gaze. So did Veek and Seth.
"Nature is random," said Alex. "Blades of grass, leaves, trees, none of them overlap, so if we're lucky, more than a few of the Seraphs and family members have been incapacitated."
Veek climbed to her feet, leaned to look out the window.
"Incapacitated meaning?"
Another scream came from outside. It broke off into ragged, wailing sobs.
The downside, alas, is that I have smashed a hole the size of this island between universes.
Alex looked at Chase.
I know you still disapprove of many of my decisions, but your electrical engineering skills would be helpful in restoring the machine if you're willing to work alongside me. And once we have repaired the tear, we can focus on our escape.
Chase tried very hard to process everything Alex had said, then zeroed in on the important word. Escape.
From the squales, as you like to call them, Alex said.
Seth's mouth twisted up.
He said they can't be stopped, that they're going to destroy the world.
They are. This world is doomed. He pointed at Veek. Once the tear is sealed, however, we can escape into hers.
My... what?
Your world, your reality.
What?
He turned to Chase.
Didn't you tell her we had more to discuss?
How would I have known this?
Alex sighed.
Two realities have collided here, even before this action I just took. The native reality, so to speak, of me and my machine is the doomed one.
He gestured at Chase and Seth.
You and your ship are also of this reality. It is my island you first came ashore on.
Okay. He turned to Veek.
You and your kidnappers, the family, are from, as we would see it, an alternate universe. You landed on Alexander's island. He has not yet awoken a creche child to replace him, as my earlier version did. He is the third. I am the fourth, but we are not the same third and fourth, if that makes sense.
No, said Seth. It doesn't.
It kinda does,
said Veek. Alex waved his hands, trying to rush past their comments.
Each of your groups has been exploring different versions of the same island. Along the way, I would guess Veek and Mr. Murdoch stumbled through one of the small fractures and ended up here, in our reality.
Another scream came from outside. Chase looked at Veek, studied her, looking for anything, something odd.
So you're from another planet?
This planet, she said. Just another version of it, not quite as messed up as this one, apparently, which is hard to believe.
What do you mean?
Said Chase.
Your world has a doomsday fish person cult?
The family exists across many realities, said Alex. Now, please, we do not have much time. I would guess we have 25 minutes at best to effect repairs before the squale returns and tears the hole between the worlds even wider, dooming both universes.
How was this a good plan?
Asked Seth.
Because if the family had gained access to Alexander's machine, they would have torn the hole open from their side, and we would not have been able to reverse it.
More wails echoed up from outside the building, and then a single gunshot.
39. The nausea and dizziness slammed into Katanga a minute after the minister shot the other fishman. It reminded him of his first time on a big container ship in high seas. Everything he'd grown used to as solid shifted underfoot, churning his stomach and playing fucking hell with his balance. At least this time he was already on his knees. He leaned forward and pressed one hand against the ground to balance himself. The man, Barnabas, let him tilt away with no attempt to stop him. A tremor ran up Katanga's throat from his gut, but he'd thrown up everything he had back at the beach. He spat out a few threads of stomach acid and tried to straighten up. His abs and arm resisted. He couldn't even lift his hand from the ground. A few cries echoed across the clearing. What was it the old man had been protecting in the building? Katanga had read internet stories about sonic weapons that caused vertigo-like effects or sometimes nausea. Had they been hit by some future weapon? He felt Barnabas paw at his back. The same nausea must have hit him, too. If Barnabas was disoriented, this might be a chance to escape. Katanga went to lean back again, and again his hand resisted. With a little soreness this time, as if he'd slammed it down on a patch of thorns or thistles. They tugged at his skin and caused just enough pain to make him stop lifting. He studied the tall grass poking up between his fingers and tried to figure out how long the thorns were. Could he just rip his hand free, or would he need to ease it back? If he took too long, he might miss his chance. It all went through his mind in seconds. He studied the long strands of grass again, couldn't see any kind of barbs in the flickering light of the flare, and decided to just yank his fingers. He bowed his head lower and leaned to the side to get more light on his hand. The grass stretched up through his fingers. Two pale blades came up from the first knuckle on his middle finger and another out of his ring finger. At least six strands came up through the back of his palm. One thin shaft was centered in the nail of his index finger. He tugged again and felt another twinge of pain, almost a dozen little twinges.
"What in God's name is this?"
he murmured to himself. Some of the cries around him had grown into screams. Had it even been a minute since the attack of dizziness? Half a minute? He went to turn, and pain sliced through his hand. Katanga gritted his teeth, lifted his pinned palm as high as he could, and wedged the fingers of his free hand beneath it. He worked them back and forth, pushing deeper, breaking through the blades of grass. Pain sparked up his arm, but his hand came free. Barnabas scrabbled at his back again. Katanga flinched and looked over his shoulder. A thick palm tree stood just a few feet behind him. He didn't remember it being there before. His guard, Barnabas, had vanished somewhere back into the dark woods. A stubby lower frond stretched out from the tree to brush at his back with its splayed leaves. Katanga pushed himself to his feet and felt more grass rip free, woven into the fabric of his jeans. Two or three strands plucked at his knee. He caught his balance and staggered back toward the tree. The palm frond snagged at his jeans, and he reached down to brush it free. It was warm and calloused and grabbed at his fingers. His stomach churned again. The hand slowed its frantic flailing. The fingers stretched open, closed, open, trembling with each movement. His gaze followed the arm back to where it vanished into the tree a few inches behind the bulky wristwatch. The man, Barnabas, had worn a watch like that. Katanga stepped around the tree. Barnabas crouched on the other side of it. He'd been driven to his knees and reached out to keep a hand on his prisoner. It looked like he'd stretched forward, determined not to fail in his task. Katanga could see the back of the other man's head sticking out of the palm tree about 2 feet above the ground, maybe part of an earlobe and jawline, the way he'd been leaning forward. No blood, not even a seam where the tree and the man's head overlapped. Barnabas kicked at the ground, slow, piston-like movements getting slower, as if trying to push himself forward through the tree and out the other side. His other elbow swung back and forth, and Katanga saw the man's fingertips had been swallowed up by the tree. The thumb flicked at the coarse surface of the trunk. He glanced down at the strands of grass running through his hand, felt the ones tickling his shins inside his jeans. His throat and empty stomach convulsed again. Katanga backed away, picking up speed as he skirted the edge of the clearing. Off to his left, the big woman, Phoebe, had her foot and lower leg trapped in the spidery roots of a tree looming in front of her. One of the tall monster things stood transfixed, embedded straight down its middle into a tree trunk. His captors wanted to get into the strange building, so it probably wasn't the best place to hide, and running toward it meant turning his back on a lot of guns. His only other option was the forest, though, which seemed to be where the monster men lived. Then the minister, Anne, appeared in front of him and took the decision out of his hands. Katanga got his hand up, but the woman had a lot of hidden muscles. Her backhand twisted three of his fingers aside to smash into the side of his head. His legs wobbled and he dropped back to his knees. He leaped, tried to dodge past her, and she shoved him back down. It was like being a child again, trying to wrestle with an adult who outmatched him in every way. The pistol trembled at the end of her arm.
"I'd prefer if you stay with us for now."
Another scream echoed between the trees. He lunged to the side and ran into another woman, the one with the oversized dark eyes and the blood-stained shirt.
She slammed the heel of her palm into his chest and he fell back on his ass. The impact jarred his twisted fingers and he wondered if Anne had broken them. The woman quickly bowed her head.
I think everyone's dead, Minister.
Anne shoved her pistol back into its holster.
Everyone? Judah's left arm and part of his chest they're in a tree. He's not dead, but I don't think he's got long. Phoebe's foot is trapped. I can't find Barnabas. Two of the Seraphs, they're sort of melted together.
Another one in a tree back there, offered Katanga. So's your man Barnabas.
Be quiet!
Just trying to help.
Her anger made his fingers hurt a little less. Anne took a breath, calmed herself.
Is your pistol still loaded?
The woman nodded.
I've only fired 3 shots. Good. Go end Judah's suffering. Do the same for any of the others.
The woman tried out a few silent words and blinked her big eyes. It made her look even more like a fish.
Is there a problem?
No, Minister.
What about Phoebe?
Anne took another breath.
Just her foot? It looked that way, yes. Somebody must have a good knife. She probably does. See if you can cut around it and get her free. And if I can't? Phoebe's a loyal and devout member of the family. Try to save as much of her foot as possible. And him?
Katanga glanced over and found the woman staring at him.
I'll deal with him,
said Anne.
Yes, Minister.
The woman bowed her head and vanished back into the woods. The flare sputtered out, taking with it the last light in the clearing. Even the soft light in the building seemed to have dimmed. Katanga checked each of the windows, looking for the glow.
You feel it too, don't you?
Anne's voice had calmed, but it sounded forced, like someone trying to have a casual conversation while dinner burned and they hoped you didn't notice.
Something's changed in there.
He said nothing.
Whatever they did, it hurt them almost as much as it hurt us. You think?
Katanga kept his mouth shut.
You can talk, it's okay.
He thought about another smart-aleck answer.
Feels like being in the eye of a storm, he finally said. Well, I'll be back in the thick of it soon enough.
Anne's dark silhouette seemed to consider it, nodded.
Yeah. Yeah, we will.
A gun went off. 1 shot. Some of the screaming stopped.
What's your name, anyway?
Katanga.
Like the sword?
Katanga, he repeated.
It wasn't supposed to go like this, Katanga. I knew there was a chance someone would be here, but I'd hoped it'd be peaceful. That they'd be ready to admit the error of their ways and we could just...
She sighed.
That's not how people work, Katanga said. Never has been. Nobody likes to admit they're wrong, no matter how plain and clear it is.
That's not true. I realized I was wrong. I'd been a non-believer my whole life, and then I saw the truth. I was wrong, and I admitted it. That's why I became a minister, because I was chosen for this.
He saw the potential minefield of responding and kept his tongue still. Instead, he rolled over onto his hip and then up onto his knees. Now he faced her in a praying position, one he could get up from much faster.
This should have been perfect,
Anne said.
There were so many signs. The Seraph found me after I left my family. We found the island.
She turned in the darkness, a twisting shadow.
How did it all go so wrong?
Another gunshot, a low moan, so steady it had become background noise, ended with a wet gurgle. A few stuttering growls rose up to mark the sudden silence. Anne barked out a few words in the guttural clicking language of the monsters. The Seraphs, the other woman had called them. A few sounds echoed back out of the darkness. Katanga wondered if he'd gurgle or go quickly. He didn't have much hope of it going any other way. The minister had shot the other man with almost no hesitation. Her childhood friend, if he'd understood correctly. Her shadowy outline shifted, twisted, and something hit the ground in front of him. It bounced and tapped his knees just as another one landed.
He felt around, found the waxy rods, felt his way up to the plastic caps.
"Light them,"
she said.
"Toss them toward the front door."
He passed the flares back and forth between his hands.
"Why?"
"Because it's too dark for them to see."
"I mean, why do you need me to do it?"
He felt her eyes on him.
"Why do you think I want to keep at least one hand free so if you try anything I can shoot you?"
One of the flares slipped and pattered to the ground.
"Okay, just light the damned things. I'm not going to kill you for no reason."
Katanga thought of the two men she'd killed in the past hour or so and felt less than certain of that. But he lit the first flare with a few quick strikes. He touched the second one to the first, giving him one in each hand. Anne stared at him. The flickering red light didn't warm her eyes. She jerked her chin toward the building. He tossed the flares, one after another. They hit the ground near the steps and lit up the dead man she'd called Murdoch. Katanga looked for the body of the old man, but the corner of the building hid it in shadows. Anne took a few steps forward, cleared her throat.
"I think we should talk,"
she called out. A few moments passed before an echoing voice responded from the building.
"You killed the last guy who came out to talk to you."
The voice pricked at Katanga's ears. He'd heard it before, he knew it, but couldn't place it.
"Murdoch was a heretic who betrayed us," said Anne. "Who betrayed me. I didn't want to do it, but it was best for everyone."
"I think we'll pass."
One of the passengers. Not the annoying one.
Chaser.
"Please,"
Anne said.
"I just want to explain our position. If you knew what we knew, you'd be opening that door and giving us a hero's welcome." "I think we know enough,"
shouted a new voice, a woman Katanga didn't recognize.
"Veek,"
said Anne.
"I should have guessed you'd find your way here. We should have just set you loose and followed you."
No response. A smell touched Katanga's nose. Gunpowder. He turned and saw the other woman standing behind him. The red light of the flares gleamed in her eyes, made her face look like blood.
"Okay, then,"
said Anne.
"I can see why you're hesitant. You've had some bad experiences with the family. I probably haven't made the best first impression, or second impression."
Still nothing from the building.
"So, same offer as before. Come out here and we won't have to kill Katanga, or any of you. And I'll tell you something you've probably never heard before."
She paused, the kind of dramatic pause that made a congregation lean forward. She let it stretch out.
"I'll tell you the truth about the machine."
40.
"You can't be serious,"
said Chase. Veek shrugged.
"I can't do much in here. You and Alex need more time to fix the machine."
"She'll kill you."
"Maybe. But if it means saving a few billion people, including my friends who I was grieving for."
She glared at Alex.
"Again, my apologies. I assumed you had reasoned out the nature of things."
"Everyone's making a lot of assumptions today about what I know,"
she muttered.
"I don't like it," said Seth.
"It doesn't thrill me either,"
she said.
"But I'm the best choice."
"I'll cover you," said Seth. "If they try anything, run back. I'll make sure they don't follow you."
"Are you some kind of sharpshooter now?"
"Cover fire isn't about hitting things. It's about making people think they might get hit."
"That's not very reassuring."
"And if you get a chance, tell Katanga this is going to be fine. Remind him this is no worse than the time we had the leopard get loose on the ship."
Chase's eyes went wide.
"The what?"
Veek raised an eyebrow.
"You had a leopard on your boat?"
"On our ship, a few years back," Seth said. "Rich man's pet. It got loose. Ran around Makara for 2 days before we caught it."
"I don't think I'm going to have a chance to remind him of all that."
"You won't have to. Just remind him of the leopard. It'll make him feel better."
"Sure, whatever. As long as he feels better about being out there."
She stepped past him to the door where Chase and Alex waited. "You'll need to be back inside once the machine is reset," Alex told her.
"Because?"
"Because once it's active, it will restore the walls and force the two realities apart again. Those of us within the machine will return to our reality, and you would end up in the other, with the family."
"Great."
"Good luck," said Chase.
"Thanks."
They slid the bolts on the door and pulled it open again. Veek counted to three, waiting for grasping hands or thrown spears to come through the gap. When none did, she stepped outside. Anne had moved three or four steps closer. She stopped in mid-stride, settled back, and raised her empty hands.
"Truce,"
she said.
"I doubt that."
The door thudded behind Veek, but she didn't hear the bolts settle back into place. She stepped halfway down the staircase, then went the rest of the way, stopping on the last slab of concrete.
"I just want to talk,"
said Anne.
"You've had years. You've got all your cultists and seraphs."
"We're not cultists,"
Anne bit off whatever else she was going to say and let an angry breath out through her nose.
Walks like a duck, quacks like a duck."
A silence stretched out between them.
"Do you really want to use this time for name-calling?" Anne asked.
Veek shrugged.
"So why are we talking?"
"If you'd prefer, I can ask the family and the seraphs to storm your building and kill everyone inside."
Something moved in the dark behind Anne. A bald man with his hands up. Dirt covered his wrinkled, damp clothes. Behind him walked a woman with a bloody shirt and the family's signature oversized eyes. She had the man at gunpoint.
"I'm not sure you could,"
Veek said.
"Neither am I. The old man's booby traps have taken a toll on us. That's why we're talking.
Hoping we'll all walk out and let you kill us more efficiently. I'm hoping to explain things. That you'll finally understand, and we can avoid all the killing. Good luck with that. Yucatanga?"
The man perked up. In the flickering light, it was hard to be sure if his expression was hopeful or suspicious. He met her eyes and nodded once.
"Seth says not to worry. Remember, this isn't any worse than when the leopard got loose."
A few different emotions flickered across the man's face.
"Seth is alive?"
"Yeah."
She tipped her head back up toward a window, not on the side everyone had been gathered around earlier.
"He's probably listening in now. If you're all done passing messages,"
said Anne,
"I'd like to get back to the matter at hand."
Veek managed a light snort and crossed her arms.
"It's good that it's you and I talking about this. Two women. The men would just mess it all up, wouldn't they?"
Anne swung a hand up at the building.
"I mean, it was a group of men who built this thing. This,
you kidnapped me, brought me halfway around the world, and killed a bunch of people. We're not going to have a girl power Me Too bonding moment."
"Fair enough."
Anne paced back and forth.
"I think the problem is you don't understand what we're trying to do."
Veek fought the urge to roll her eyes.
"I've got a pretty good idea." "Do you? You want to set the squales loose to destroy the world?"
Anne's mouth dropped open.
"No. No, that's not it at all. We're trying to protect the world. We want to save it. I mean, look at it."
"What the hell is that supposed to mean?"
Anne threw Veek's confused look right back at her.
"Where have you been for the past 50 years?
"I'm not even 40.
"Look at the world, Veek. Overpopulation problems, climate change, food shortages. Pretty much everything's unstable, and you know why?"
Veek shook her head, still off guard from the abrupt turn the conversation had taken.
"Because it was never supposed to get this big."
Anne pointed at the vine-covered facade of the building.
"You want the truth? Well, the truth is, the machine, this place, did this to the world. It let things go on too long. It disrupted the natural order."
Veek opened her mouth to say something, but Anne plowed over her without giving her a chance.
"That's what the family is all about. We're the good guys,"
she insisted.
"We want to set things back to the way they're supposed to be.
the way they were before Kotorovich and Tesla and the rest of those idiots built this machine. They're the bad guys, Veek. They're the ones who put the world at risk. All we want to do is shut it down, so the great ones can move through and restore things to the way they were intended to be. This is your big chance, Veek. You can be the woman who saves the world. That's what I'm trying to...
No, Anne said, cutting her off again.
You're trying to get the machine working again, aren't you? I can tell it's off. I can smell it in the air. And so you're saying we should... What? Don't you get it? If you want to save the world, just don't do anything. Just sit back and let things happen. With the machine shut down, the great ones can finally pass through into our world and restore balance. You and me, Veek, we can save the world from itself.
Veek stared at the woman. In the light of the red flares, her smile and wide eyes made her into something out of a horror movie.
If they get into this world, they're just going to eat. Yes, exactly. You're talking about killing billions of people. Billions. And none of them ever should have been born,
said Anne.
You've heard about accident kids, the ones Mom and Dad never planned on? Well, there's 6 billion accidents on Earth right now. Just think how much better things would be without them. Unless you happen to be one of them, Thanos. Are you going to help me save the world?
Veek shook her head.
You want to know what I think? Of course. I think you sound like one of those kids you always read articles about,
said Veek.
The ones who go away to some nutjob religious Bible camp and come back brainwashed against evolution and tolerance and stuff like that. The ones who get taught to win discussions by shouting over everyone with an opposing view. You're so blind with belief you don't realize how crazy you sound.
Anne's face got hard. The angles of her cheeks and jaw stood out. It made her look sharp, alien.
Fuck you. I've been there,
said Veek.
I know what a world looks like when they're done with it, when they've restored balance. It's not back to normal. It's just dead.
Anne let her chin sink down.
They aren't coming through to save the world,
said Veek.
They're coming through to eat it, all of it. No one's going to survive. No one's going to be chosen. If you do this, your family gets devoured just like the rest of us. You're so wrong. Maybe,
said Veek.
But I don't think so. You know what they call us? Cattle. Maybe they like all your prayers and worship, but in the end, that's all we are to them. Food. You're dooming the whole world, Veek. You're not stupid. You can see how things are. Humanity's only got a decade or two left if the great ones aren't allowed to perform their function. Yeah,
she said.
That's Bible camp talking again. My gods, speak to me. A lot of farmers talk to their livestock,
said Veek.
Doesn't change how things turn out for the cows at the end of the season.
Anne glared at her.
I think we're done here,
Veek said.
Don't you? Yes,
Anne said.
I think we are.
The door hinges creaked. Veek heard feet shuffle on the steps above her.
Whenever you're ready, said Chase.
Veek nodded and never took her eyes off Anne.
Thanks for the talk. Of course. You know you're completely nuts, right? No. I just have faith. We're doing the right thing.
Anne coughed on the last word. The cough became a wet, stuttering sound in her throat. She leaned her head back, opening her mouth wide as she called out to the seraphs. 41. Chase heard the noises Anne made and recognized them. Now, he yelled to Veek, opening the door wide. Veek turned, made it up one step, and something blurred between them, just a blink of white in a line alongside the top of her head. Next to his waist.
It was gone by the time she reached the second step, but the air still trembled. By the time she reached the third step, Seth's pistol went off. The gunshot echoed inside the machine, ringing off steel and copper and glass. He fired three more times before Veek dove through the doorway and Chase slammed the wooden door shut. A heartbeat later, it shook twice with heavy impacts. He slammed the top bolt back into place, bent and slapped the lower one over.
"He got away," Seth said.
Veek sucked in a breath, rolled over onto her back, and took two more.
"Whew, got away."
"Katanga."
Chase looked up and saw Alex standing at the foot of the stairs. He'd been resetting the switches there after undoing his modifications up in the control area. Now he leaned on the slanted railing, almost hanging off it. He tilted forward and his ragged safari vest swung open for a moment to reveal the shiny red on his shirt underneath.
"Oh, hell," said Chase.
Alex held out the handkerchief in his fingers. It sparkled with shards of glass.
"I'm afraid they broke the valve," he said. "We'll need to get a replacement, quickly."
Chase ran over and managed to catch him before he collapsed. Blood had soaked into the vest now, too.
"What happened?" "One of their spears," said Alex. "It came through the open door. Smashed the valve, went straight through me as well."
He looked to Veek.
"You know where the storeroom is?"
"Yes."
Alex pushed the handkerchief at her.
"Second shelf left of the door, third shelf up from the bottom."
She ran away down the central catwalk, the metal clanging beneath her heels. Chase peeled away the vest and tried to find the entry wound hidden in the bloody linen. He spotted a darker, wetter area and pressed his hand over it. The wound pulsed beneath his palm, soaking his fingers. Alex winced and hissed through gritted teeth.
"We need to stop the bleeding," Chase said.
He worked his other hand around the man's torso, searching for the exit wound.
"Seth, give me a hand."
A hard thunk came from the door, the sounds of an axe slamming into a tree. It came again, and again. Between the impacts, Chase heard the wet, guttural clicks of the Seraphs. Alex shook his head.
"It's too late for me. I know anatomy well enough, especially my own."
"We can give you more time."
"There's no time left to give. Don't waste what little there is trying to save a man with a mortal wound. You're the only one here with the electronics knowledge to finish what we've begun."
He pointed at the wooden door.
"You'll have to open it. You can get out that way."
"We're all going to make it out, don't worry."
"There's a chance I already did."
Alex coughed out a laugh and sprayed some blood on Chase's shoulder.
"There may be another of me out there in the world. Some world."
Veek came back with a stack of boxes.
"I can't tell them apart without my glasses, so I just grabbed all of them."
Alex nodded weakly.
"The bottom one. Hurry, everything else is set."
Veek and Seth shifted the boxes, exposing the lowest one.
"Somebody has to take over here," said Chase. "The spear went straight through him."
"Gog,"
yelled Seth.
"Get down here and help, skinny rat."
The door shook from the repeated blows. A slow, splintering noise ended with a crack. Chase pictured spears prying gouges out of the door and tried to remember how thick it was. Seth dropped to his knees and put his hands by Chase's.
"I have him. Go."
Chase pulled his hands away, wiped his hands on his jeans, and plucked a paper package from the box. Four quick steps carried him over to the bank of vacuum tubes Alex had sabotaged earlier. He unrolled the paper from the new tube as he searched for the empty socket.
"Don't touch it with your bare hands," said Veek. "You'll get oil and blood on it."
He nodded and wrapped the paper back around the glass portion. He reached over the other tubes, lined up the prongs with the socket, and glanced back at the others.
"Everyone clear of everything?"
"Do it,"
said Seth. Chase nodded, took a breath, and pushed the tube down into its socket. Nothing happened.
"Son of a bitch,"
muttered Veek. He shifted the paper around the vacuum tube, wiggled it free, pushed it back down into the socket again. He felt the prongs catch just as it clicked into place. Still nothing.
There must be a break in the system somewhere,
Alex said with a wet cough.
Something else they damaged.
Another crack came from the door. Veek shot up.
The spear.
Chase stepped away from the tubes.
What? The spear.
She stepped past Seth and Alex, heading back into the machine.
It went through him. Where did it go?
He joined her on the catwalk.
Can you see okay?
I'm pretty sure I'll see a 7-foot bone spear.
What has bones that big?
Haven't figured that one out yet.
She pointed.
There it is.
The spear was a white line in the dim light. As Chase pulled it free, the smell of overdone ribs and ozone wafted across his nose.
Damn it.
What?
I think it cut something. Do you have a light on you?
No.
What happened to the big floodlight thing?
It's back there, but it plugs into the building, too.
Great.
He took a deep breath through his nose. Definitely some ozone in the air. He peered at the bundle of dark cables. At least 5, all different sizes, all blurring together. He reached back away from the spear's impact point and gave the whole bundle a shake. No sparks. Chase heard a swish of fabric and the cables brightened a bit, just enough for him to make out the individual cables and a few details. He looked over at Veek and saw that she'd slid out of her black suit jacket, exposing the white shirt underneath. She held her arms out, trying to cup and reflect the emergency light.
That's better,
he said. He moved his hand a foot farther along the cable and she shuffled around, angling her body to follow him. And there it was. The spear had cut an eerily clean slice into one of the thinner cables and through most of the copper wires inside. Chase studied the bundle, pushed, and got a small pop and a spark.
Good news is, I don't think it shorted anything out. It's just an air gap.
Which means what?
I need a pair of pliers, at least.
There were some tools in the storeroom.
Good. Pliers, wire cutters, some electrical tape.
Wouldn't bet on that.
Spare cable insulation, then. Insulated gloves I can tear up. Band-aids. Something. And I need to find the other end of this.
Can you trace it without the extra light?
She wiggled her arms.
Yeah, I think so, now that I know where the exposed wires are.
He swung the spear up and balanced it so it stood by the nearly severed cable.
I'll be right back.
She turned and almost slammed into a tall figure standing there. Chase fumbled with the pistol in his belt, remembered it was empty, and reached for the spear.
Hey, said the shape. It's me, Chaser.
Katanga?
Yes,
the man tilted his head. He looked exhausted.
What the hell is this place? It's like being inside an old radio.
Yeah, I know.
Chase looked behind the man into the depths of the machine. How'd you get inside?
I ran around the building and came in through the back door.
How'd you know there was a back door?
Asked Veek.
Just because I work on a ship doesn't mean I've never seen a building before. Thanks for the warning, by the way.
What warning?
The Leopard. It had a deckhand trapped and Seth shot it.
Wait,
said Chase. The back door was open?
Not anymore. I locked it behind me when I came in.
You sure?
Have you seen those things? Yes, I am sure I locked the door.
Where is my electrical power?
Wheezed Alex from the front platform.
Pliers,
said Veek. She took off running.
And maybe wire cutters,
Chase called after her. He looked back at Katanga and pointed toward the front.
Seth and Doug are up there. They could probably use a hand.
A hand.
The family's trying to break in.
Katanga processed the phrase, nodded, jogged down the catwalk. Chase crouched and ran his hand along the cables, keeping his index finger pressed against the damaged one. He passed over a few loops of string, bundling the lines together through a porcelain insulator, worked his way around a metal strut, and almost yanked his hand away once when something with too many legs skittered across his knuckles. Almost a full minute of crouch walking along brought him to what felt like some kind of junction box. He couldn't get a good look at it in the dim light, but he could see the connector. A little prying got it loose. The cable ended in a bulbous plug with 3 round pins. He didn't recognize the connector design off the top of his head, but wouldn't be surprised if the machine had a lot of custom elements.
Doug!
Shouted Seth. Chase stopped, listened to the sounds of chopping. The echo of Seth's shout vanished into the depths of the machine.
Where the hell is Doug?
Seth yelled. 42. Doug, after careful consideration, had decided to make a run for it. Granted, his careful consideration had only taken him about 3 minutes. He'd watched the hot cultist woman shoot the fishman, Murdoch. It was true, the hot ones were always crazy, and realized this was the second person who'd died in front of him in just a couple of hours. I'm in the pit, and now Murdoch. Doug was a big believer in art imitating life, which meant, logically, art was a lot like life, and he'd spent a lot of time watching art on Netflix and Vudu and Tubi, real art, not just binging Voltron and Stranger Things and Sex Education. He understood how stories happened in art, which meant he had a good sense of how things happened in real life. Two less important people had been killed off, which meant, according to the rule of three, it was time for someone important to die. Someone like him. Not that his life was inherently more valuable than anyone else's, but come on. A fish man and a guy who worked on a boat? Doug was an artist, a documentarian. He contributed to culture, and he always composted his biodegradables. When he was at home, anyway. There was no question who sat higher on the food chain. Plus, how did the old saying go? Trouble always came in threes. Another sign things didn't look good for him. All of this had flashed through his mind as he saw Veek head out to talk with the cult woman, saw Seth aiming his pistol between two boards across a window, watched Chase and the castaway mad scientist guy, Alex, run around reversing whatever it was they'd done in the first place, turning the big machine building into some kind of vomitorium, like doing bad mushrooms and getting on one of those spinning carnival rides Middle America loved. He'd understood enough of the conversation to know they'd moved into another world. More important, it seemed clear to him this world wasn't under threat. Not yet, anyway. When the shooting started, Doug had grabbed Alex's old rifle from the control area, yanked open the back door, and made a beeline for the trees. Not easy in the dark. He'd tripped over a rock almost immediately, lost his bearings, and then just kind of ran wildly for a minute or two. Distance was his first priority, putting as much space between him and the building and all the people trying to kill each other at the building as quickly as possible. Now he'd been moving through the forest at a good pace, the rifle out in front of him like he'd seen on countless TV shows and movies. His eyes had adjusted to the dark as best they could, and it kept him from running into a tree. Moving at a brisk pace rather than running saved him from tripping over anything else. He also knew, deep, deep inside, that all this was wrong. He was distracted by the hunger. He wasn't thinking right. Clearly he wasn't thinking right. Sure, he was hungry, but he'd been eating cockroaches. Live cockroaches with green shells and extra legs, which meant they were probably radioactive or laced with chemicals or something. They had something to do with these different worlds. That's all he understood. He'd sort it out later, once he got away. Away from the fighting, away from the building, away from this goddamned island. Murdoch had told them about a yacht on the other side of the island. Doug's sense of direction hadn't worked great here on said goddamned island, and his compass was useless, but he was pretty sure he could still manage to find the coast. That's where the yacht would be. His literal ticket out of here. And the yacht would have food. Actual food. Cans of food. Frozen food. Drinks. Snacks. Real snacks. Not more cockroaches. A sharp snap echoed in the forest, a larger twig or one of those big palm fronds. They were almost like wood when they dried out. He had to be careful not to step on any more of those. They were harder to see in the dark, but he didn't want to lead anyone or anything right to him. But had he stepped on that one? Doug bent his knees and crouched, low to the ground. He felt around in the weeds and tall grass, banged his fingertips straight into a jagged rock. Couldn't find a twig or frond.
Had he stopped as soon as he heard the snap? Whatever he stepped on could be two or three paces behind him, if he'd stepped on anything. Doug had seen a lot of movies, after all. Not all of them art. He'd watched a few horror movies, just to mock them, of course. He knew what the breaking twig in the woods usually meant. And art did imitate life. He straightened up and headed toward the beach, and he picked up the pace. The yacht would be another issue. He didn't know how to drive a boat, but he knew it had a steering wheel and ignition, so it was probably close enough to a car for him to figure out the basics, enough to get him away from the island and back to the mainland, or at least to where he'd be seen and rescued. He also had to consider the possibility there'd be people on the yacht, a staff or crew or something, depending on how big it was. Would they be loyal to the fish people? Would they be fish people themselves? Fish people probably wouldn't need a boat, so he felt safe guessing they'd be like him, in which case it would just be about convincing them to take him away from here. He could explain the situation, offer them money, do manual labor. Or maybe it would come down to the rifle. He couldn't think of anything he wouldn't do if it meant getting away from... Another crack. Louder this time. Closer. Something thicker breaking. He definitely hadn't stepped on something that time. Doug looked around, willing his eyes to see better in the dark. The trees around him blocked some of his view, but nothing seemed to be out there around him. No movement at all. No sound either. The island had been quiet since they arrived, but now, alone in the dark, it seemed especially quiet. Too quiet, as all the good storytellers would say. Were there more trees around him? A trick of the dark, maybe? Or were his eyes adjusting even more, showing him things he hadn't been able to see a few minutes ago? He took a breath, got his bearings again, and his nerves snapped. Doug ran, suddenly all too aware of where he sat on the food chain. He sprinted through the night, dodging the tall palm trunks and squat bushes as they appeared out of the darkness. The tall grass dragged across his shins and smacked at his knees. Some of the thicker clumps caught at his toes, turning his run into a stumble for a few paces. He caught a flicker of movement and something bumped hard into his shoulder, the kind of hit from someone passing too close on a crowded sidewalk. It knocked him a step to the left, and he made it two more strides before the pain reached his brain. Burning, searing pain radiated out of his arm, making him gasp for air. His balance gone, his rhythm shot. The old rifle almost slipped from his hands. He swung his head to the side and saw a dark stain spreading down to his elbow. Doug lumbered for three more steps before his knee hit something hard and locked. The pain in his arm vanished as he almost drowned in the impact. Nails and broken glass and razors filled his knee, cut at the flesh, scraped at the bone. It yanked him back, almost flipped him over. Trying to keep his balance somehow made the agony even worse. He dropped his weapon, let himself sag, and the broken glass tore its way up his thigh, drove the nails into his spine, chopped at the base of his skull. He tried to scream, but all the muscles in his throat had seized up so tight he could barely whimper. Doug inched his chin down, each movement causing another jolt of pain. His body sat slightly forward, with his frozen, excruciating leg just behind him. He tried to wiggle those toes and felt the inside of his sock and his boot and what felt like a half dozen needles jabbed under his kneecap from different directions. A branch of pale wood ran through his leg. He'd run around in the dark, stumbled, and impaled himself on it. It stretched out almost 3 feet from his knee and into the trunk of a... No, 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 no. The spear passed through his knee, just behind his kneecap, between his leg bones. Maybe through the base of his thigh bone. Tilting his head to look at it made him shift his weight, and the needles he felt became hot, burning spikes. One of the monster people,
appeared out of the darkness, a particularly lopsided one, with one of its tusks stretching up almost past its double-eyed socket. It stalked toward him, and two more loped out of the night behind it.
"Please,"
Doug gasped. He said other words after that. Mindless things. Nothing could get out of his brain past all the sensations shoving their way in. Tusk brushed Doug's arms aside and tapped his knee right where the spear entered. It took the long shaft once, setting off a fireworks display of acid and bee stings inside his leg. Then it slid a long, pale knife from the strap of its loincloth and sliced down. The pain shot through Doug's body, a complete circuit of agony. His world faded to white static after the second cut. For a time, all he knew was white electric pain and thunder booming in his ears.